Our Lady of Mercy was funded by the Chicago Archdiocese and was one of the Cardinal's pet projects. Bill Nader had carried the scars of 2 bullet wounds, one in his left shoulder and one in his right calf, and had lost 2 Vietnamese priests and 1 previous American to Viet Cong terrorists. From the moment of Stefan's arrival, during his entire tour of duty in the war zone, he never doubted that he would survive or that his work in that hell on earth was worthwhile. When Saigon fell, Bill Nader, Stefan Vikazic, and 13 nuns escaped the country with 126 children. Hundreds of thousands died in the subsequent bloodbath, but even in the face of mass slaughter, Stefan Vikazic never doubted that 126 lives were a very significant number. Never allowed despair to grip him. Back in the States, as a reward for his willingness to be the Cardinal's troubleshooter for a decade and a half, Stefan was offered a promotion to Monsignor, which he modestly declined. Instead, he humbly requested and was rewarded with his own parish, at long last. That was St. Bernadette's. It had not been a prosperous parish when it was put into Stefan Vikazic's able hands. St. Bernadette's was $125,000 in debt. The church was in desperate need of major repairs, including a new slate roof. The rectory was worse than decrepit. It threatened to come tumbling down in the next high wind. There was no parish school. Attendance at Sunday Masses had been on a steady decline for almost 10 years. St. Bet's, as some of the altar boys referred to it, was precisely the kind of challenge that excited Father Vikazic. He never doubted that he could rescue St. Bet's. In 4 years, he raised the attendance at Mass by 40%, retired the debt, and repaired the church. In 5 years, he rebuilt the parish house. In 7 years, he doubled attendance and broke ground for a school. In recognition of Father Vikazic's unflagging service to Mother Church, the Cardinal, in his last week of life, had conferred the coveted honor of P.R., permanent rector, on Stefan, guaranteeing him life tenure at the parish that he had single-handedly brought back from the edge of both spiritual and financial ruin. The granite solidity of Father Vikazic's faith made it difficult for him to understand why, at the early Mass on the Sunday just past, Father Brendan Cronin's belief had dissolved so completely as to cause him to fling the sacred chalice across the chancel in despair and rage, in front of almost 100 worshippers. Dear God! At least it had not happened at one of the 3 later Masses, which were better attended. Initially, when Brendan Cronin had come to St. Bet's more than a year and a half ago, Father Vikazic had not wanted to like him. For one thing, Cronin had been schooled at the North American College in Rome, reputedly the most splendid educational institution within the jurisdiction of the Church. But though it was an honor to be invited to attend that establishment, and though its graduates were considered the cream of the priesthood, they were often effete dainties, loath to get their hands dirty, with much too high an opinion of themselves. They felt that teaching catechism to children was beneath them, a waste of their complex minds. And visiting shut-ins was a task they found unspeakably distasteful after the glories that had been Rome. In addition to the stigma of being trained in Rome, Father Cronin was fat. Well, not fat, really, but certainly plump, with a round, soft face and liquid green eyes that seemed, at first encounter, to betoken a lazy and perhaps easily corrupted soul. Father Vikazic, on the other hand, was a big-boned Pole whose family had not contained a single fat man. The Vikazics were descended from Polish miners who had emigrated to the United States at the turn of the century, taking physically demanding jobs in steel mills, quarries, and the construction trades. They had produced big families that could be supported only through long hours of honest labor, so there wasn't time to get fat. Stefan had grown up with an instinctual sense that a real man was solid but lean, with a thick neck, big shoulders, and joints gnarled from hard work. To Father Vikazic's surprise, Brendan Cronin had proved to be a hard worker. He had acquired no pretensions and no elitist opinions while in Rome. He was bright, good-natured, amusing, and he thrived on visiting shut-ins, teaching the children, and soliciting funds. He was the best curate Father Vikazic had been given in 18 years. That was why Brendan's outburst on Sunday, and the loss of faith that had inspired it, was so distressing to Stefan Vikazic. Of course, on another level, he looked forward to the challenge of bringing Brendan Cronin back into the fold. He had begun his career in the church as a strong right arm for priests in trouble, and now he was being called upon to fill that role once more, which reminded him of his youth and engendered in him a buoyant feeling of vital purpose. Now, as he took another sip of coffee, a knock came at the office door. He turned his gaze to the mantel clock. It was of ormolu and inlaid mahogany, with a fine Swiss movement, a gift from a parishioner. That timepiece was the only elegant object in a room boasting strictly utilitarian and mismatched furniture and a threadbare imitation Persian carpet. According to the clock, the time was 8:30, precisely, and Stefan turned to the door, saying, "Come in, Brendan." As he came through the door, Father Brendan Cronin looked no less distressed than he had on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, when they had met in this office to discuss his crisis of faith and to search for ways to reestablish his belief. He was so pale that his freckles burned like sparks on his skin, and by contrast, his auburn hair looked more red than usual. The bounce had left his step.
"Sit down, Brendan. Coffee?"
"Thank you, no." Brendan bypassed the tattered Chesterfield and the Morris chair, slumping in the sag-bottomed wingback instead. "Did you eat a good breakfast?" Stefan wanted to ask. "Or did you just nibble at some toast and swill it down with coffee?" But he did not want to seem to be mothering his curate, who was 30 years old, so he said,
"You've done the reading I suggested?"
"Yes." Stefan had relieved Brendan of all parish duties and had given him books and essays that argued for the existence of God and against the folly of atheism from an intellectual point of view.
"And you've reflected on what you've read?"
Father Vikazic said.
"So, have you found anything so far that helps you?"
Brendan sighed, shook his head.
"You continue to pray for guidance?"
"Yes, I've received none."
"You continue to search for the roots of this doubt?"
"There don't seem to be any." Stefan was increasingly frustrated by Father Cronin's taciturnity, which was utterly unlike the young priest. Usually, Brendan was open, voluble, but since Sunday he had turned inward, and he had begun to speak slowly, softly, and never at length, as if words were money and he a miser who begrudged the paying out of every penny.
"There must be roots to your doubt," Father Vikazic insisted. "There must be something from which doubt's grown. A seed, a beginning."
"It's just there," Brendan muttered, barely audible. "Doubt. It's just there as if it's always been there."
"But it wasn't. You did believe. So when did doubt begin?" "Last August, you said, but what sparked it? There must have been a specific incident or incidents that led you to reevaluate your philosophy."
Brendan gave a softly exhaled, "No." Father Vikazic wanted to shout at him, shake him, shock him out of his numbing gloom, but he patiently said,
"Countless good priests have suffered crises of faith. Even some saints wrestled angels, but they all had two things in common. Their loss of faith was a gradual process that continued many years before reaching a crisis, and they could all point to specific incidents and observations from which doubt arose. The unjust death of a child, for instance, or a saintly mother stricken with cancer. Murder. Rape.
Why does God allow evil in the world? Why war? The sources of doubt are innumerable, if familiar, and though church doctrine answers them, cold doctrine is sometimes little comfort. Brendan, doubt always springs from specific contradictions between the concept of God's mercy and the reality of human sorrow and suffering.
Not in my case, Brendan said.
Gently but insistently, Father Vikazic continued, and the only way to assuage that doubt is to focus on those contradictions that trouble you and discuss them with a spiritual guide.
In my case, my faith just collapsed under me, suddenly, like a floor that seemed perfectly solid but was rotten all along.
You don't brood about unjust death, sickness, murder, war, like a rotten floor, then, just collapsed overnight.
That's right.
Bullshit, Stefan said, launching himself up from his chair. The expletive and the sudden movement startled Father Cronin. His head snapped up and his eyes widened with surprise. Bullshit, Father Vikazic repeated, matching the word with a scowl as he turned his back on his curate. In part, he intended to shock the younger priest and force him out of his half-trance of self-pity, but in part he was also irritated by Cronin's uncommunicative funk and stubborn despair. Speaking to the curate, but facing the window where patterns of frost decorated the panes and where wind buffeted the glass, he said, "You didn't fall from committed priest in August to atheist in December. Could not. Not when you claim you've had no shattering experiences that might be responsible. There must be reasons for your change of heart, Father, even if you're hiding them from yourself, and until you're willing to admit them, face them, you'll remain in this wretched state." A plumbless silence filled the room. Then, the muffled ticking of the ormolu and mahogany clock. At last, Brendan Cronin said,
"Father, please don't be angry with me. I have such respect, and I value our relationship so highly that your anger, on top of everything else, is too much for me right now."
Pleased by even a thread-thin crack in Brendan's shell, delighted that his little stratagem had produced results, Father Vikazic turned from the window, moved quickly to the wing-back chair, and put a hand on his curate's shoulder.
"I'm not angry with you, Brendan.
Worried? Concerned? Frustrated that you won't let me help you, but not angry."
The young priest looked up.
"Father, believe me. I want nothing more than your help in finding a way out of this. But in truth, my doubt doesn't spring from any of the things you mentioned. I really don't know where it comes from. It remains, well, mysterious."
Stefan nodded, squeezed Brendan's shoulder, returned to his chair behind the desk, sat down and closed his eyes for a moment, thinking.
"All right, Brendan.
Your inability to identify the cause of your collapsed faith indicates that it's not an intellectual problem, so no amount of inspirational reading will help. If it's a psychological problem, the roots lie in your subconscious, awaiting revelation." When he opened his eyes, Stefan saw that his curate was intrigued by the suggestion that his own inner mind was simply malfunctioning, which meant God hadn't failed Brendan after all. Brendan had failed God. Personal responsibility was far easier to deal with than the thought that God was unreal or had turned his back. Stefan said, "As you may know, the Illinois provincial of the Society of Jesus is Lee Kellogg. But you may not know that he oversees two psychiatrists, both Jesuits themselves, who deal with the mental and emotional problems of priests within our order. I could arrange for you to begin analysis with one of those psychiatrists."
"Would you?"
Brendan asked, leaning forward in his chair.
"Yes, eventually, but not right away.
If you begin analysis, the provincial will refer your name to the province's prefect of discipline, who will begin to pick through your actions of the past year to see if you've violated any of your vows.
But I never...
I know you never, Stefan said reassuringly. But the prefect of discipline's job is to be suspicious. The worst thing is, even if your analysis leads to a cure, the prefect will scrutinize you for years to come, to guard against a lapse into unpriestly conduct, which would limit your prospects. And until your current problem, Father, you struck me as a priest who'd go far. Monsignor, perhaps higher.
Oh, no, certainly not me, Brendan said self-deprecatingly.
Yes, you. And if you beat this problem, you could still go far. But once you're on the prefect's danger list, you'll always be suspect. At best, you'll wind up no better than me, a simple parish priest. A smile flickered at the corners of Brendan's mouth.
It would be an honor, and a life well spent to be, as you say, no better than you.
But you can go farther, and be of great service to the church. And I'm determined you'll have that chance. So I want you to give me until Christmas to help you find a way out of this hole. No more pep talks. No debates about the nature of good and evil. Instead, I'll apply some of my own theories about psychological disorders. You'll get amateur treatment from me. But give it a chance. Just until Christmas. Then, if your distress is still as great, if we're no nearer an answer, I'll put you in the hands of a Jesuit psychiatrist. Deal?
Brendan nodded. Deal.
Terrific, Father Vikosik said, sitting up straight, rubbing his hands together briskly, as if about to chop wood or perform some other invigorating exercise. That gives us more than 3 weeks. For the first week, you'll put away your ecclesiastical suits, dress in ordinary clothes, and report to Dr. James McMurtry at St. Joseph's Hospital for Children. You'll see that you're assigned to the hospital staff.
As chaplain?
As an orderly. Emptying bedpans, changing bedclothes, whatever is required. Only Dr. McMurtry will know you're a priest.
Brendan blinked. But what's the point of this?
You'll figure it out before the week is up, Stefan said happily. And when you understand why I sent you to the hospital, you'll have one important key to help you unlock your psyche, a key that'll open doors and give you a look inside yourself. And maybe then you'll see the cause of your loss of faith and overcome it.
Brendan looked doubtful.
Father Vikosik said, You promised me 3 weeks.
All right.
Brendan unconsciously fingered his Roman collar and seemed disturbed by the thought of removing it,
which was a good sign.
You'll move out of the rectory until Christmas. I'll give you funds to pay for meals and an inexpensive hotel room. You'll work and live in the real world beyond the shelter of the ecclesiastic life. Now, change clothes, pack your suitcases, and report back to me. Meanwhile, I'll call Dr. McMurtry and make the necessary arrangements.
Brendan sighed, got up, and went to the door. There's one thing maybe supports the notion that my problem's psychological, not intellectual. I've been having these dreams. Actually, the same dream every time.
A recurring dream? That's very Freudian.
I've had it several times a month since August. But this week it's become a regular occurrence. 3 out of the last 4 nights. It's a bad one, too. A short dream that I have over and over again in one night. Short, but intense. It's about these black gloves.
Black gloves.
Brendan grimaced. I'm in a strange place. Don't know where. I'm lying in bed, I think. I seem to be restrained. My arms are held down, and my legs. I want to move, run, get out of there, but I can't. The light is dim, can't see much. Then these hands.
He shuddered. hands wearing black gloves? Father Bikosik prompted.
Yes. Shiny black gloves. Vinyl or rubber. Tightly fitted and shiny, not like ordinary gloves.
Brendan let go of the doorknob, took two steps toward the middle of the room, and stood with his hands raised before his face, as if the sight of them would help him recollect the details of the menacing hands in his dream.
I can't see whose hands they are.
Something wrong with my vision. I can see the hands, the gloves, but only up to the wrists. Beyond that, it's all blurry. By the offhanded way that Brendan had mentioned the dream, almost as an afterthought, he obviously wanted to believe that it was of no consequence. However, his face was paler than before, and there was a vague but unmistakable flutter of fear in his voice. A burst of winter wind rattled the loose window pane, and Stefan said, "The man with black gloves, does he say anything to you?"
"He never speaks."
Another shudder. Brendan lowered his hands, thrust them in his pockets.
"He touches me.
The gloves are cold. Slick." The curate looked as if he could feel those gloves even now. Acutely interested, Father Bikosik leaned forward in his chair and said, "Where do these gloves touch you?" The young priest's eyes glazed.
"They touch my face, forehead, cheeks, neck, chest. Cold. They touch me almost everywhere."
"They don't hurt you?"
"No."
"But you're afraid of these gloves, of the man wearing them?"
"Terrified. But I don't know why."
"One can't help but see how Freudian a dream it is."
"I suppose,"
the curate said. Dreams are a way for the subconscious mind to send messages to the conscious, and in this case, it's easy to see Freudian symbolic meanings in these black gloves. The hands of the devil, reaching out to pull you down from grace, or the hands of your own doubt. Or they could be symbols of temptations, of sins, seeking your indulgence. Brendan seemed grimly amused by the possibilities.
"Especially sins of the flesh. After all, the gloves do touch me all over."
The curate returned to the door and put his hand on the knob, but paused again.
"Listen, I'll tell you something odd. This dream, I'm half sure it's not symbolic."
Brendan let his gaze slide away from Stefan's, down to the worn rug.
"I think those gloved hands represent nothing more than gloved hands. I think somewhere, some place, at some time or other, they were real."
"You mean you were once in a situation like the one in your dream?"
Still looking at the rug, the curate said,
"I don't know. Perhaps in my childhood? See, this might not have anything to do with my crisis of faith. The two things might be, probably are, unconnected."
Stefan shook his head. "Two unusual and serious afflictions, a loss of faith and a recurring nightmare troubling you at the same time, and you want me to think they've no relation? Too coincidental. There must be some connection. But tell me, at what point in your childhood would you have been menaced by this unseen, gloved figure?"
"Well, I had a couple of serious illnesses as a boy. Maybe during a fever I was examined by a doctor who was a little rough or scary-looking. And maybe the experience was so traumatic that I repressed it and now it's coming back to me in a dream."
"When doctors wear gloves for an examination, they use throwaway white latex, not black, and not heavy rubber or vinyl gloves."
The curate took a deep breath, blew it out.
"Yeah, you're right. But I just can't shake the feeling that the dream's not symbolic. It's crazy, I suppose, but I'm sure those black gloves are real. As real as that Morris chair, as real as those books on the shelf? On the mantel, the clock struck the hour. The soughing of the wind in the eaves became a howl.
Creepy, Stefan said, referring not to the wind or the hollow striking of the clock.
He crossed the room and clapped the curate on the shoulder.
But I assure you, you're wrong. The dream is symbolic, and it is related to your crisis of faith. The black hands of doubt. It's your subconscious warning you that you're in for a real battle. But it's a battle in which you're not alone. You've got me beside you.
Thank you, Father.
And God. He's beside you as well.
Father Cronin nodded, but there was no conviction in his face or in the defeated hunching of his shoulders.
Now, go pack your suitcases, Father Vikazic said.
I'm leaving you short-handed when I go.
I've got Father Drano and the sisters at the school. Now, off with you.
When his curate had gone, Stefan returned to his desk. Black gloves. It was only a dream, not particularly frightening in its essence. Yet Father Cronin's voice had been so haunted when he spoke of it that Stefan was still affected by the image of shiny, black, rubber-clad fingers reaching out of the blur and prodding. Poking. Black gloves. Father Vikazic had a hunch that this was going to be one of the most difficult salvage jobs upon which he had ever embarked. Outside, snow fell. It was Thursday, December 5th.
4. Boston, Massachusetts. On Friday, 4 days after the catastrophic fugue that followed the aortal graft on Viola Fletcher, Ginger Weiss was still a patient at Memorial Hospital, where she had been admitted after George Hanaby led her out of the snowy alleyway in which she had regained consciousness. For 3 days, they had put her through exhaustive tests, an EEG study, cranial X-rays, sonograms, pneumoventriculography, a lumbar puncture, an angiogram, and more, repeating the several procedures, though fortunately not the lumbar puncture, for cross-checked results. With the sophisticated tools and processes of modern medicine, they searched her brain tissue for neoplasms, cystic masses, abscesses, clots, aneurysms, and benign gummatous lumps. For a while, they concentrated on the possibility of malignancies of the paraneural nerves. They checked for chronic intracranial pressure. They analyzed the fluid from the spinal tap in search of abnormal protein, cerebral bleeding, a low sugar count that would indicate bacterial infection or signs of a fungus infection. Because they were physicians who always gave their best to a patient, but especially because Ginger was one of their own colleagues, her doctors were diligent, determined, thoughtful, thorough, and firmly committed to pinpointing the cause of her problem. At 2 o'clock Friday afternoon, George Hanaby came to her room with the results of the final battery of tests and with the reports of consultants who had given one last round of opinions. The fact that he had come himself, rather than let the oncologist or the brain specialist, who were in charge of her case, bring the news, most likely meant that it was bad. And for once, Ginger was sorry to see him. She was sitting in bed, dressed in blue pajamas that Rita Hanaby, George's wife, had been kind enough to fetch, along with a suitcase full of other necessities, from the Beacon Hill apartment. She was reading a paperback mystery, pretending to be confident that her seizures were the result of some easily corrected malady, but she was scared. But what George had to tell her was so bad that she could no longer hold fast to her composure. In a way, it was worse than anything for which she had prepared herself. They had found nothing. No disease, no injury, no congenital defect, nothing. As George solemnly outlined the final results and made it clear that her wild flights, performed in a fugue, were without a discernible pathological cause, she finally lost control of her emotions for the first time since she had broken into tears in the alleyway. She wept, not noisily, not copiously, but quietly and with enormous anguish. A physical ailment might have been correctable, and once cured, it would not have prevented her from returning to a career as a surgeon. but the test results and the opinions of the specialists all conveyed the same unbearable message. Her problem was entirely in her mind, a psychological illness beyond the reach of surgery, antibiotics, or controlling drugs. When a patient suffered repeated incidents of fugue for which no physiological cause could be found, the only hope of ending the seizures was psychotherapy, though the finest psychiatrists could not boast of a high cure rate with patients thus afflicted. Indeed, a fugue was often an indication of incipient schizophrenia. Her chances of managing her condition and living a normal life were small. Her chances of institutionalization were dismayingly high. Within reach of her lifelong dream, within months of beginning her own surgical practice, her life had been shattered as thoroughly as a crystal goblet struck by a bullet. Even if her condition was not that extreme, even if psychotherapy gave her a chance to control her strange outbursts, she'd never be able to obtain a license to practice medicine. George plucked several Kleenex from the box on the nightstand and gave them to her. He poured a glass of water. He got a Valium and made her take it, though at first she resisted. He held her hand, which seemed like that of a very small girl when clasped in his large mitt. He spoke softly, reassuringly. Gradually, he calmed her. When she could speak, she said,
"But George, damn it, I wasn't raised in a psychologically destructive atmosphere. Our home was happy, at peace, and I certainly got more than my share of love and affection. I wasn't physically, mentally, or emotionally abused."
She angrily snatched the box of tissues from the nightstand, tore Kleenex from it.
"Why me? How could I, coming from my background, develop a psychosis? How? With my fantastic mother, my special papa, my damned if it wasn't happy childhood, how could I wind up seriously mentally disturbed? It isn't fair. It isn't right. It isn't even believable."
He sat on the edge of her bed, and he was so tall that he still loomed over her.
"First of all, doctor, the consulting specialists tell me there's a whole school of thought that says many mental illnesses are the result of subtle chemical changes in the body, in the brain tissue, changes we're not yet advanced enough to detect or understand. So this doesn't have to mean that you're screwed up by your childhood. I don't think you've got to reevaluate your whole life because of this. Second, I'm not, I repeat, not at all convinced that your condition is anything as serious as debilitating psychosis."
"Oh, George, please don't coddle—"
"Coddle a patient? Me?"
he said, as if no one had ever suggested anything half as astonishing to him.
"I'm not just trying to lift your spirits. I mean what I say. Sure, we didn't find a physical cause for this, but that doesn't mean there isn't a physical problem involved. You might have a condition that's not yet sufficiently advanced to be detectable in a couple of weeks, or a month, or as soon as there's any worsening of the problem. Any indication of deterioration, we'll run more tests. We'll take another look, and I'd bet everything I own that we'll eventually put our finger on the problem."
She allowed herself to hope. Discarding a wadded mass of tissues, she fumbled for the Kleenex box.
"You really think it could be like that? A brain tumor? Or an abscess so small it doesn't show up yet?"
"Sure. I find that a hell of a lot easier to believe than that you're psychologically disturbed. You? You're one of the steadiest people I've ever known. And I can't accept that you could be psychotic, or even psychoneurotic, and not exhibit unusual behavior between these fugues. I mean, serious mental illness isn't expressed in neatly contained little bursts. It slops over into the patient's entire life."
She had not thought about that before. As she considered his point, she felt a little better, though not wildly hopeful, and certainly not happy. On the one hand, it seemed weird to be hoping for a brain tumor, but a tumor could be excised, perhaps without gross damage to cerebral tissues. Madness, however, responded to no scalpel. The next few weeks or months are probably going to be the most difficult of your life. The waiting.
I suppose I'm restricted from hospital work for the duration?
Yes. But depending on how you come along, I don't see why you can't help me out at the office.
And what if I threw one of these fits?
I'd be there to keep you from hurting yourself until it passed.
But what would your patients think? Wouldn't exactly help your practice any, would it? To have an assistant who suddenly turns into a mashugana and runs shrieking through the office?
He smiled. Let me worry about what my patients think. Anyway, that's for the future. Right now. At least for a week or two, you've got to take it easy. No work at all. Relax. Rest. These last few days have been emotionally and physically exhausting.
I've been in bed.
Exhausting?
Don't knock a teapot.
He blinked, confused. Don't what?
Oh,
she said, surprised to have heard those four words pop out of her.
It's something my father used to say. It's a Yiddish expression. Hocknet kan chaynik.
Don't knock a teapot.
It means don't talk nonsense. But don't ask me why it means that. It's just something I used to hear all the time when I was a kid.
Well, I'm not knocking a teapot. You may have been in bed all week, but it's been an exhausting experience nonetheless, and you need to take it easy for a while. I want you to move in with Rita and me for the next few weeks.
What? Oh, I couldn't impose on you.
It's no imposition. We have a live-in maid, so you won't even have to make your bed in the morning. From the guest room window, you'll have a nice view of the bay. Living around water is calming. In fact, it's quite literally what the doctor ordered.
No. Really, thank you, but I couldn't.
He frowned. You don't understand. I'm not just your boss, but your doctor, and I'm telling you this is what you're going to do.
I'll be perfectly fine at the apartment.
No, he said firmly. Think about it. Suppose one of these seizures struck while you were making dinner. Suppose you knocked over a pot on the stove. It could start a fire, and you might not even be aware of it until you came out of the fugue, by which time the whole apartment could be ablaze and you could be trapped. That's only one way you might hurt yourself. I can think of 100. So I have to insist that, for a while, you must not live alone. If you don't want to stay with me and Rita, do you have relatives who take you in for a while?
Not in Boston. In New York, I've got aunts, uncles.
But Ginger could not stay with any of her relatives. They would be happy to have her, of course, especially Aunt Francine or Aunt Rachel. However, she did not want them to see her in her current condition, and the thought of pitching a fit in front of them was intolerable. She could almost see Francine and Rachel huddling over a kitchen table, speaking in low voices, clucking their tongues.
Where did Jacob and Anna go wrong? Did they push her too hard? Anna always pushed her too hard, and after Anna died, Jacob relied on the girl too much. She had to take over the house at 12. It was too much for her. Too much pressure, too young.
Ginger would receive considerable compassion, understanding, and love from them, but at the risk of sullying the memory of her parents, a memory she was determined to honor, always. To George, who still sat upon the edge of the bed and awaited her response with an obvious concern that touched her deeply, she said,
I'll take the guest room with the view of the bay.
Splendid!
Though I think it's a horrible imposition. And I warn you, if I really like it there, you might never get rid of me. You'll know you're in trouble if you come home someday and I've hired people to repaint the walls and hang new drapes.
He grinned. At the first mention of painters or draperies, we'll throw your butt out in the street. He kissed her lightly on the cheek, got up from the edge of the bed, and walked to the door. I'm going to start the release procedures now, so you should be out of here in 2 hours. I'll call Rita and have her come pick you up. I'm sure you can beat this thing, Ginger. But you've got to keep thinking positive. When he left the room and his footsteps faded down the hall, she stopped struggling to maintain her smile, and it collapsed instantly. She leaned back against her pillows and stared morosely at the age-yellowed acoustic tile on the ceiling. After a while, she got out of bed and went into the adjoining bathroom, where she approached the sink with trepidation. After a brief hesitation, she turned on the water and watched it whirling around and into the drain. On Monday, at the surgical scrub sink, after successfully performing the aortal graft on Viola Fletcher, Ginger had been panicked by the sight of water swirling into a drain, but she could not imagine why. Damn it! Why? She desperately wanted to understand. Papa, she thought, I wish you were alive, here to listen, to help. Life's nasty surprises had been the subject of one of Papa's little sayings that Ginger had once found amusing. When anyone fretted about the future, Jacob would shake his head and wink and say,
Why worry about tomorrow? Who knows what'll hit you today?
How true, and how utterly unamusing now. She felt like an invalid. She felt lost. It was Friday, December 6th. 5. Laguna Beach, California. When Dom went to the doctor's office on Monday morning, December 2nd, in the company of Parker Fane, Dr. Koblitz did not recommend immediate diagnostic procedures, for he had only recently given Dom a thorough examination and had seen no signs of physical disorder. He assured them there were other treatments to be tried before jumping to the conclusion that it was a brain disorder that sent the writer scurrying upon errands of fortification and self-defense in his sleep. After Dom's previous visit, on November 23rd, the physician had, he said, become curious about somnambulism and had done some reading on the subject. With most adults, the affliction was short-lived. However, in a few cases, there was a danger of it becoming habitual, and in its most serious forms, it resembled the inflexible routines and pattern-obsessed behavior of worst-case neurotics. Once habitual, somnambulism was much harder to cure, and it could become the dominant factor in the patient's life, generating a fear of night and sleep, producing profound feelings of helplessness, culminating in more serious emotional disorders. Dom felt he was already in that danger zone. He thought of the barricade he had built across his bedroom door, the arsenal on the bed. Koblitz, intrigued and concerned but not worried, had assured Dominic and Parker that in most instances of persistent somnambulism, the pattern of nocturnal rambling could be broken by the administration of a sedative before bed. Once a few untroubled nights had passed, the patient was usually cured. In chronic cases, the nightly sedative was augmented with a diazepam compound during the day when the patient was plagued by anxiety. Because the tasks that Dominic performed in his sleep were unnaturally strenuous for a somnambulist, Dr. Koblitz had prescribed both Valium during the day and a 15-milligram tablet of Dalmane just before slipping under the covers each night. On the drive back to Laguna Beach from Dr. Koblitz's office in Newport, with the sea on the right and hills on the left, Parker Fane argued that, until the sleepwalking stopped, it was not wise for Dom to continue living alone. Hunched over the steering wheel of his Volvo, the bearded and shaggy-haired artist drove fast, aggressively, but not recklessly. He seldom glanced away from the Pacific Coast Highway, yet he gave the impression, through the sheer force of his personality, that his eyes and attention were fixed constantly and entirely upon Dom.
There's plenty of room at my place. I can keep an eye on you. I won't hover, mind you. I won't be a mother hen, but at least I'll be there. And we would have plenty of opportunity to talk about this, really get into it, just you and me, and try to figure how this sleepwalking is related to the changes you went through the summer before last, when you threw away that job at Mountain View College. I'm definitely the guy to help you. I swear, if I hadn't become a goddamn painter, I'd have become a goddamn psychiatrist. I have a knack for getting people to talk about themselves. How about it? Come stay with me for a while, and let me play therapist.
Dom had refused. He wanted to stay at his own house, alone, for to do otherwise seemed to be a retreat into the same rabbit hole in which he had hidden from life for so many years. The change he had undergone during his trip to Mountain View, Utah, the summer before last, had been dramatic, inexplicable, but for the better. At 33, he had finally seized the reins of life, had mounted it with a flourish, and had ridden into new territory. He liked the man he had become, and he feared nothing more than slipping back into his dreary former existence. Perhaps his somnambulism was mysteriously related to the previous changes of attitude that he had undergone, as Parker insisted, but Dom had his doubts that the relationship was either mysterious or complex. More likely, the connection between the two personality crises was simple. The sleepwalking was an excuse to retreat from the challenges, excitement, and stress of his new life, which could not be allowed. Therefore, Dom would stay in his own house, alone, take the Valium and Dalmain as Dr. Koblitz had prescribed them, and tough this thing out. That was what he had decided in the Volvo on Monday morning, and by Saturday, the 7th of December, it seemed that he had made the correct decision. Some days he needed a Valium, and some days he did not. Every evening he took a Dalmain tablet with milk or hot chocolate. Somnambulism disturbed his nights less frequently. Before beginning drug therapy, he walked in his sleep every night, but in the past 5 nights he journeyed just twice, leaving his bed only in the pre-dawn hours of Wednesday and Friday mornings. Furthermore, his activities in his sleep were far less bizarre and less disturbing than they had been. He no longer gathered up weapons, built barricades, or tried to nail the windows shut. On both occasions, he merely left his beauty rest for a makeshift bed in the back of the closet, where he woke stiff and sore and frightened by some unknown and nameless threat that had pursued him in dreams he could not recall. Thank God, the worst seemed past. By Thursday, he had begun to write again. He worked on the new novel, picking up where he left off weeks ago. On Friday, Tabitha Wycombe, his editor in New York, called with good news. 2 pre-publication reviews of Twilight in Babylon had just come in, and both were excellent. She read them to him, then revealed even better news. Bookseller excitement, aroused by industry publicity and by the distribution of several hundred advance reading copies, continued to grow, and the first printing, which had already been raised once, was now being raised again. They talked for almost half an hour, and when Dom hung up, he felt that his life was back on the rails. But Saturday night brought a new development, which might have been either a turn for the better or the worse. Every night that he had gone walking in his sleep, he had been unable to recall even the smallest detail of the nightmares that drove him from his bed. Then, Saturday, he was plagued by an uncannily vivid, terrifying dream that sent him fleeing through the house in somnambulistic panic. But this time he remembered part of it when he woke. Not most of it, but at least the end. In the last minute or two of the dream, he was standing in a half-glimpsed bathroom, everything blurred. An unseen man shoved him against a sink, and Dom bent over it, his face thrust down into the porcelain bowl. Someone had an arm around him and was holding him on his feet, for he was too weak to stand on his own. He felt rag limp, and his knees were quivering, and his stomach was twisting and rolling. A second unseen person had 2 hands on his head, forcing his head into the sink. He could not speak. He could not draw breath. He knew he was dying. He had to get away from these people, out of this room, but he did not have the physical resources to take flight. Though his vision remained bleary, he could see the smooth porcelain and the chrome-plated rim of the drain in detail, for his face was only inches from the bottom of the sink. It was an old-fashioned drain, without a mechanically operated stopper. The rubber plug had been removed and set aside, somewhere out of sight. The water was running, spewing out of a faucet, past his face, splattering against the bottom of the basin, whirling around and around, down into the drain, around and down. The 2 people forcing him into the sink were shouting, though he could not understand them, around and down, around. Staring hypnotically into the miniature whirlpool, he grew terrified of the gaping drain, which was like a sucking orifice intent upon drawing him into its reeking depths. Suddenly, he was aware they wanted to stuff him down into the drain, dispose of him. Might be a garbage disposal in there, something that would chop him to pieces and flush him away. He woke, screaming. He was in his bathroom. He had walked in his sleep. He was at the sink, bent over, screaming into the drain. He leapt back from that gaping hole, stumbled, nearly fell over the edge of the bathtub. He grabbed a towel rack to steady himself. Gasping for breath, shaking, he finally got up enough nerve to return to the sink and look into it. Glossy white porcelain, a brass drain rim, and a dome-shaped brass stopper. Nothing else. Nothing worse. The room in his nightmare had not been this room. Dominic washed his face and returned to the bedroom. According to the clock on the nightstand, it was only 2:25 a.m. Though it made no sense at all, and seemed to have no symbolic or real connection with his life, the nightmare was profoundly disturbing. However, he had not nailed windows shut or gathered up weapons in his sleep, so it seemed that this was only a minor setback. In fact, it might be a sign of improvement. If he remembered his dreams, not just pieces, but all of them, from beginning to end, he might discover the source of the anxiety that had made a night rambler of him. Then he would be better able to deal with it. Nevertheless, he did not want to go back to bed and risk returning to that strange place in his dream. The bottle of Dalmane was in the top drawer of the nightstand. He was not supposed to take more than one tablet each evening, but surely one indulgence couldn't hurt. He went out to the bar cabinet in the living room, poured some Chivas Regal. With a shaky hand, he popped the pill in his mouth, drank the Chivas, and returned to bed. He was improving. Soon the sleepwalking would stop. A week from now, he'd be back to normal. In a month, this would seem like a curious aberration, and he'd wonder how he'd allowed it to get the better of him. Precariously prone upon the trembling wire of consciousness above the gulf of sleep, he began to lose his balance. It was a pleasant feeling, a soft slipping away. But as he floated down into sleep, he heard himself murmuring in the darkness of the bedroom, and what he heard himself saying was so strange it startled him, and piqued his interest even as the Dalmane and whiskey inexorably had their way with him. "The moon," he whispered thickly. "The moon. The moon." He wondered what he could possibly mean by that, and he tried to push sleep away at least long enough to ponder his own words. "The moon? The moon," he whispered again, and then he was gone. It was 3:11 a.m., Sunday, December 8th. Six. New York, New York. 5 days after stealing more than $3 million from the Fratellanza, Jack Twist went to see a dead woman who still breathed. At 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon, in a respectable neighborhood on the east side, he parked his Camaro in the underground garage beneath the private sanitarium and took the elevator up to the lobby. He signed in with the receptionist and was given a visitor's pass. One would not think the place was a hospital. The public area was tastefully decorated in Art Deco style, suited to the building's period. There were two small Erte originals, sofas, one armchair, tables with neatly arranged magazines, and all the furniture had a 1920s look. It was too damn luxurious. The Ertes were unnecessary. 100 other economies were obvious, but the management felt that image was important in order to continue to attract upper-crust clientele and keep the annual profit around the 100% mark. The patients were of all types: middle-aged, catatonic schizophrenics, autistic children, the long-term comatose, both young and old. But they all had two things in common. Their conditions were all chronic rather than acute, and they were from well-to-do families who could afford the best care. Thinking about the situation, Jack invariably became angry that no place in the city provided fine custodial care for the catastrophically brain-injured or mentally ill at a reasonable price. In spite of huge expenditures of tax money, New York's institutions, like public institutions everywhere, were a grim joke that the average citizen had to accept for a lack of alternatives. If he had not been a skilled and highly successful thief, he would not have been able to pay the sanitarium's exorbitant monthly charges. Fortunately, he had a talent for larceny. Carrying his visitor's pass, he went to another elevator and rode up to the fourth of six floors. The hallways in the upper levels were more reminiscent of a hospital than the lobby had been. Fluorescent lights, white walls, the clean, crisp, minty smell of disinfectant. At the far end of the fourth-floor hall, in the last room on the right, lived the dead woman who still breathed. Jack hesitated with his hand on the pushplate of the heavy swinging door, swallowed hard, took a deep breath, and finally went inside. The room was not as sumptuous as the lobby, and it was not Art Deco, either, but it was very nice, resembling a medium-priced room at the Plaza. A high ceiling and white molding, a fireplace with a white mantle, a deep hunter-green carpet, pale green drapes, a green leaf-patterned sofa and a pair of chairs. The theory was that a patient would be happier in a room like this than in a clinical room. Although many patients were oblivious of their surroundings, the cozier atmosphere at least made visiting friends and relatives feel less bleak. The hospital bed was the only concession to utilitarian design, a dramatic contrast to everything else, but even that was dressed up with green-patterned designer sheets. Only the patient spoiled the lovely mood of the chamber. Jack lowered the safety railing on the bed, leaned over, and kissed his wife's cheek. She did not stir. He took one of her hands and held it in both of his. Her hand did not grip him in return, did not flex, remained slack, limp, senseless. But at least it was warm.
"Jenny. It's me, Jenny. How are you feeling today? You look good. You look lovely.
You always look lovely."
In fact, for someone who had spent 8 years in a coma, for someone who had not taken a single step and had not felt sunshine or fresh air upon her face in all that time, she looked quite good indeed. Perhaps only Jack could say that she was still lovely, and mean it. She was not the beauty she had once been, but she certainly did not look as if she had spent almost a decade in solemn flirtation with death. Her hair was not glossy anymore, though still thick and the same rich chestnut shade as when he had first seen her at her job behind the men's cologne counter in Bloomingdale's 14 years ago. The attendants washed her hair twice a week here and brushed it every day. He could have moved his hand under her hair, along the left side of her skull, to the unnatural depression, the sickening concavity. He could have touched it without disturbing her, for nothing disturbed her anymore. But he did not, because touching it would have disturbed him. Her brow was uncreased, her face unlined, even at the corners of her eyes, which were closed. She was gaunt, though not shockingly so. Motionless upon those green designer sheets, she seemed ageless, as if she were an enchanted princess awaiting the kiss that would wake her from a century of slumber. The only signs of life were the vague, rhythmic rise and fall of her breast as she breathed, and the soft movement of her throat as she occasionally swallowed saliva. The swallowing was an automatic, involuntary action and not a sign of awareness on any level whatsoever. The brain damage was extensive and irreparable. The movements she made here and now were virtually the only movements she would ever make until, at last, She gave a dying shudder. There was no hope. He knew there was no hope, and he accepted the permanence of her condition. She would have looked much worse if she had not received such conscientious care. A team of physical therapists came to her room every day and put her through passive exercise routines. Her muscle tone was not the best, but at least she had muscle tone. Jack held her hand and stared down at her for a long time. For 7 years, he had been coming to see her 2 nights a week, and for 5 or 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, sometimes on other afternoons as well. But in spite of the frequency of his visits, and in spite of her unchanging condition, he never tired of looking at her. He pulled up a chair and sat next to the bed, still holding her hand, staring at her face, and for more than an hour he talked to her. He told her about a movie that he had seen since his previous visit, about 2 books he had read. He spoke of the weather, described the force and bite of the winter wind. He painted colorful word pictures of the prettiest Christmas displays he had seen in shop windows. She did not reward him with even a sigh or a twitch. She lay as always, unmoving and unmoved. Nevertheless, he talked to her, for he worried that a fragment of awareness might survive, a gleam of comprehension down in the black well of the coma. Maybe she could hear and understand, in which case the worst thing for her was being trapped in an unresponsive body, desperate even for one-way communication, but receiving none because they thought she could not hear. The doctors assured him that these worries were groundless. She heard nothing, saw nothing, knew nothing, they said, except what images and fantasies might sputter across short-circuiting synapses of her shattered brain. But if they were wrong, if there was only one chance in a million that they were wrong, he could not leave her in that perfect and terrible isolation. So he talked to her as the winter day beyond the window changed from one shade of gray to another. At 5:15 he went into the adjoining bathroom and washed his face. He dried off and blinked at his reflection in the mirror. As on countless other occasions, he wondered what Jenny had ever seen in him. Not one feature or aspect of his face could be called handsome. His forehead was too broad, ears too big. Although he had 20/20 vision, his left eye had a leftward cast, and most people could not talk to him without nervously shifting their attention from one eye to the other, wondering which was looking at them when, in fact, both were. When he smiled, he looked clownish, and when he frowned, he looked sufficiently threatening to send Jack the Ripper scurrying for home and hearth. But Jenny had seen something in him. She had wanted, needed, and loved him. In spite of her own good looks, she had not cared about appearances. That was one of the reasons he had loved her so much, one of the reasons he missed her so much, one of 1,000 reasons. He looked away from the mirror. If it was possible to be lonelier than he was now, he hoped to God that he never slipped down that far. He returned to the other room, said goodbye to his unheeding wife, kissed her, smelled her hair once more, and got out of there at 5:30. In the street, behind the wheel of his Camaro, Jack looked at passing pedestrians and other motorists with loathing. His fellow men, the good, kind, gentle, righteous people of the straight world, would regard him with disdain and possibly even disgust if they knew he was a professional thief, though it was what they had done to him and to Jenny that had driven him to crime. He knew anger and bitterness solved nothing, changed nothing, and hurt no one but himself. Bitterness was corrosive. He did not want to be bitter. But there were times when he could not help it. Later, after dinner alone at a Chinese restaurant, he returned to his apartment. He had a spacious one-bedroom co-op in a first-class building on Fifth Avenue, overlooking Central Park. Officially, it was owned by a Liechtenstein-based corporation, which had purchased it with a check written on a Swiss bank account, and each month the utilities and the association fees were paid by the Bank of America out of a trust account. Jack Twist lived there under the name Philippe Delon. To the doorman and other building employees, to the few neighbors with whom he spoke, he was known as the odd and slightly disreputable scion of a wealthy French family who had sent him to America ostensibly to scout investments, but actually just to get him out of their hair. He spoke French fluently and could speak English with a convincing French accent for hours without slipping up and revealing his deception. Of course, there was no French family, and both the corporation in Liechtenstein and the Swiss bank account were his, and the only wealth he had to invest was that which he had stolen from others. He was not an ordinary thief. In his apartment, he went directly to the walk-in closet in the bedroom and removed the false partition at the rear of it. He pulled two bags from the secret 3-foot-deep storage space and took them into the dark living room, not bothering to turn on lights. He piled the bags beside his favorite armchair, which stood by a large window. He got a bottle of Beck's from the refrigerator, opened it, and returned to the living room. He sat in the darkness for a while, by the window, looking down on the park, where lights reflected off the snow-covered ground and made strange shadows in the bare-limbed trees. He was stalling, and he knew it. Finally, he switched on the reading lamp beside the chair. He pulled the smallest of the two bags in front of him, opened it, and began to scoop out the contents. Jewels. Diamond pendants, diamond necklaces, glittering diamond chokers. A diamond and emerald bracelet. 3 diamond and sapphire bracelets. Rings, brooches, barrettes, stick pins, jeweled hat pins. These were the proceeds of a heist that he had pulled off single-handedly 6 weeks ago. It should have been a 2-man job, but with extensive and imaginative planning, he had found a way to handle it himself, and it had gone smoothly. The only problem was that he had gotten no kick whatsoever from the heist. When a job had been successfully concluded, Jack was usually in a grand mood for days after. From his point of view, these were not simply crimes, but also acts of retribution against the straight world. Payment for what it had done to him and to Jenny. Until the age of 29, he had given much to society, to his country. But as a reward, he had wound up in a Central American hellhole, in a dictator's prison, where he had been left to rot. And Jenny. He could not bear to think about the condition in which he had found her when, at last, he had escaped and come home. Now, he no longer gave to society, but took from it, and with intense pleasure. His greatest satisfaction was breaking the rules, taking what he wanted, getting away with it. Until the jewelry heist 6 weeks ago. At the end of that operation, he had felt no triumph, no sense of retribution. That lack of excitement scared him. It was, after all, what he lived for. Sitting in the armchair by the window, he piled the jewelry in his lap, held selected pieces up to the light, and tried once more to gain a feeling of accomplishment and revenge. He should have disposed of the jewelry in the days immediately following the burglary, but he was reluctant to part with it until he had squeezed at least a small measure of satisfaction from it. Troubled by his continued lack of feeling, he put the jewels back into the sack from which he had taken them. The other sack contained his share of the proceeds from the robbery at the Fratellanza warehouse 5 days ago. They had been able to open only one of the two safes, but that had contained over $3,100,000, more than $1 million apiece in untraceable 20s, 50s, and 100s. By now he should have begun to convert the cash into cashier's checks and other negotiable instruments for deposit by mail in his Swiss accounts. However, he held on to it because, as with the jewelry, the possession of it had not yet given him a sense of triumph. He removed thick stacks of tightly banded currency from the bag and held them, turned them over in his hands. He brought them to his face and smelled them. That singular scent of money was usually exciting in itself, but not this time. But he did not feel triumphant, clever, lawless, or in any way superior to the obedient mice who scurried through society's maze exactly as they were taught. He just felt empty. If this change in him had occurred with the warehouse job, he would have attributed it to having stolen from other thieves rather than from the straight world. But his reaction subsequent to the jewelry heist had been the same, and that victim had been a legitimate business. It was his ennui following the jewelry store action that caused him to move on to another job sooner than he should have. Usually, he pulled off one job every 3 or 4 months, but only 5 weeks had elapsed between his most recent operations. All right, so maybe the usual thrill eluded him on both these recent jobs because the money was no longer important to him. He had set aside enough to support himself in style for as long as he lived, and to take care of Jenny, even if she endured a normal lifespan in her coma, which was unlikely. Perhaps, all along, the most important thing about his work had not been the rebellion and defiance of it as he had thought. Perhaps, instead, he had done it all just for the money, and the rest of it had been merely cheap rationalization and self-delusion. But he could not believe that. He knew what he had felt, and he knew how much he missed those feelings now. Something was happening to him, an inner shifting, a sea change. He felt empty, adrift, without purpose. He dared not lose his love of larceny. It was the only reason he had for living. He put the money back into the bag. He turned out the light and sat in the darkness, sipping Beck's and staring down at Central Park. In addition to his recent inability to find joy in his work, he had been plagued by a recurring nightmare, more intense than any dream he had ever known. It had begun 6 weeks ago, before the jewelry store job, and he'd had it 8 or 10 times since. In the dream, he was fleeing from a man in a motorcycle helmet with a darkly tinted visor. At least, he thought it was a motorcycle helmet, although he could not see many details of it, or anything else of the man who wore it. The faceless stranger pursued him on foot through unknown rooms and along amorphous corridors and most vividly along a deserted highway that cut through an empty, moon-washed landscape.